I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we start today with news from Texas, where this afternoon the Board of Education is expected to approve proposed changes in the state's social studies curriculum. The new curriculum emphasizes Christianity, conservative figures like Ronald Reagan, Phyllis Schlafly, and Joseph McCarthy, and it asks students to question the solvency of Social Security, for instance. Members of both sides of the political aisle have expressed concern. Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News is with us. Wayne, a lot of attention is being paid to this because Texas buys so many books, it impacts publishers nationwide. They passed these proposed changes yesterday, vote later today, but still a crucial amendment up for debate. It says that students should be instructed that the separation of church and state as practiced is unconstitutional. Tell us more about that debate.
Well, that really comes, it's fundamental in this debate. I mean, this is all about the debate throughout on the social studies curricula has been about an effort by conservatives on the board to reflect a more conservative political worldview in the textbooks and in the curricula for high school and grade school students in Texas that will, as you say, reflect other folks. And nothing is more central to that, to these social conservatives on the board, than this bugaboo, this idea, which they consider to be a construct by liberal judges, of the separation of church and state. And so that has been a battle throughout. How do you reflect what the First Amendment means and what it doesn't mean? And I should say that the conservatives on the board, their position essentially is that the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, doesn't bar the government from promoting religion if it's Christian religion. It does bar the government and was created at the time in the 18th century in order to not make the same mistake that happened in Britain, where the government picked one denomination, say, the Anglican Church, over Baptists or Methodists or Presbyterians.
Well, Wayne, here's a question. When it comes to these textbooks, are these board members saying that that issue should be debated and here are both sides of the debate? Or are they saying that issues like that and issues like others that have been suggested, de-emphasizing Thomas Jefferson, saying that Joseph McCarthy was justified in his search for communists, are they saying that that should be delivered as the only history?
Well, you're really raising a good point. What they want and the intent, clearly, if you listen to the months, really, of debate on this issue, is for that to be presented, those ideas to be presented as the only history. Mm. But in the end, the way these curricula standards are being written, they very often reflect the idea students ought to discuss or ought to deal with or ought to analyze. But specifically, when they say you ought to analyze the role of Phyllis Schlafly, or we need to sort of compare and contrast different ideas about the separation of church and state, then it invites the opportunity to move to the conservative position that there really isn't a difference between a separation between church and state.
Well, the debate has been a bitter one in all communities. They've gotten over 40,000 comments, and we said, you know, both sides of the aisle have expressed concern. Former Education Secretary Rod Paige, a Republican, is one of them. He was superintendent of Houston schools before working in George W. Bush's White House. He said the school board's decisions are doing damage to the state's education system. We just want to ask you about one other change that is expected to be voted in, though. And this one you could be look at through different lenses. Board member Barbara Cargill insisted that there be a reference in school books to the singer Julius Lorenzo Cobb Bledsoe. As she said, how could any of us forget his rendition of Old Man River? Now, you can smile and say, well, we think more of Paul Robeson, but we looked up Cobb Bledsoe, and he's a Texan, but the first African-American to really sing that role in Old Man River. We're going to listen to a little of it, but, you know, maybe people should know about him.
Actually, it's hard to make an argument that a lot of these things ought to be taught to kids. A lot of things. Kids got to learn all sides of many issues, but I think much of the debate by many of the social conservatives has been aimed at limiting what they hear, not at broadening the effect of what they hear.
Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News, as we listen to Cobb Bledsoe, who grew up in Waco, Texas. Wayne, thanks so much.
It's great to be with you.
Question. What would you do if you found out you had cancer. Bruce Feiler did as most of us would. He cried. His first thoughts were of his wife and twin daughters, but he also wondered, will they ever walk again? After all, the cancer was in his leg, and Bruce Feiler is that walking guy, author of Walking the Bible. But as we said, his first concern was his three-year-old identical twin daughters. If he died, how would they remember him? He came up with the idea of creating a group of six men from all parts of his life. He called them the Council of Dads and wrote them a letter with this request.
Will you help be their dad? Will you listen in on them? Will you answer their questions? Will you take them out to lunch every now and then? Will you go to a soccer game if you're in town? Will you watch their ballet moves for the umpteenth time? Will you give them advice? Will you be tough, as I would be? And as time passes, will you introduce them to somebody who might help one of their dreams come true? Will you tell them how proud I would be? Will you be my voice?
Bruce Feiler's new book is The Council of Dads, My Daughters, My Illness, and the Men Who Could Be Me. He joins us from the Carnegie Hall Studios. And Bruce, when we spoke with you last fall from this same studio, it was then your book about Moses, we didn't even know you were going through this.
I was at the time probably at the tail end. I was on crutches for 15 months, and I think I must have come on crutches that day. And as a mark of kind of where I stand today, I walk into the studio today without anything.
Terrific to hear that. But what a story you tell of this cancer. Let's tell people. The diagnosis was in 2008. In the same spot where you broke your leg as a child, tell us about this cancer that was discovered.
600 people a year get an osteosarcoma. 85% are under the age of 21. The same disease that Ted Kennedy's son lost his leg to in the early 1970s. 15 years ago, they would have cut off my leg and hoped, and there was a 15% survival rate. But they determined in the 80s that one regimen of chemo was effective, and I went down that road and basically had 5 months of chemo, a 15-hour surgery in which doctors took out my femur and replaced it with titanium and then sent me back for chemo. Mm. Only two people before me had ever survived that surgery.
And here you are. As we said, your first and foremost thoughts are of your twin girls, but you are also thinking, I'm the guy who walked the Bible. How weird is this?
To me, I set up this sort of tension. Use my daughters as fuel to fight the cancer and fight the cancer for my daughters. And I just had this whole series of thoughts in those very early hours of the art projects I wouldn't mess up and the boyfriends I wouldn't scowl at and the aisles I wouldn't walk down. And a couple days later, I awoke with this idea of how I might give the girls my voice. And I got out of bed. And the first time I kind of articulated this idea to myself that I would call this group of men the Council of Dads, as soon as I said it, I felt like the idea kind of leapt from my head and kind of filled the room around me. And the thing I most wanted at the time was to live long enough to assemble this group. And then it's when I started talking to the group that I realized, oh my gosh, the wisdom I'm hearing could really inspire other people.
Give us just some examples. You've got Jeff Shumlin. You went on an student exchange trip with him after high school. You've got David Black. He was your agent, who at one point made a really bad deal for you, really messed you up financially. Ben Sherwood, another friend, sort of the contrarian of your group. Just give us a little more sense of who they were and what they brought.
We ended up with my oldest friend, my camp counselor, my college roommate, my business partner, my confidant, a tortured romantic poet friend. I asked them each to convey a different idea, how to live, how to travel, how to dream, different sides of me. And then when I sat down and said, give me the one piece of advice that you would give to our girls, their answers really tickled. They surprised me. They amused me. But ultimately, I found the whole thing very, very touching. And that was really the heart of the project for me. It was what the wisdom would be. So you mentioned Jeff, who was lead student trips. His philosophy has always been be a traveler, not a tourist. And so when I went to him, I said, what would you tell our girls about how to take a trip? He said, I would tell them to approach a trip as a child might approach a mud puddle. And you can look over and look at your reflection and maybe stick your finger in and make a small ripple. Or you can plunge in and thrash around and jump around and see what it feels like and smells like. And I would tell your girls, I want to see you back here at the end of your first trip, dripping in mud. After this conversation, I went to my wife, Linda, and I said, you're just not going to believe it, because this advice, it's designed to kind of change our girls' lives, but really it's going to change our lives too. And to me, that's really the kind of dirty little secret about this, Robin, is we did it for the girls, but really we've been the ones who've been transformed.
And your friends seem to be transformed as well. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like to have someone come up to you and say, I want you to take my place as a parent. I mean, for them, there was a lot of introspection. David Black, your agent, who, as we said, you had a rough patch with him. All of these people seem to sit up a little straighter when you ask them this.
David's a literary agent, and an agent is a broker of dreams in a world in which most dreams don't come true. And that's what we wanted him to convey to our girls. So I said to him, you know, what's the best thing you can give to a dreamer? And he said, the belief in yourself. And I said, but when I first met you, I didn't believe. I was at a wall. And he said, I don't see the wall. Of course, you may encounter a wall from time to time, but you find a way to get over it. And I think that one of the things that was so great about these conversations is how rare it is to sit down to your closest friends and say, this is what you really mean to me. Friends kind of get pushed aside. We certainly felt that as parents of young children. And I think in a lot of ways what the Council of Dads has proven to be is this kind of building a bridge between your friends and your family, finding a way to invite your friends into the heart of your kids' lives that may be an old-fashioned American idea, but that's one that we've lost in many ways.
Another friend you approached, Max Steyer, who was your former college roommate at Yale. His father had died when Max was three, the same age your twins were when you got your diagnosis. And his father killed himself. Very powerful conversations you end up having with Max. But we also learn that there was a suicide in your family tree. We learn a lot about the men on each side of the girls' tree. You're on your side and on your wife's side.
You mentioned my grandfather. He left behind at the time of his death 28 cassette tapes chronicling his rise from dirt poverty in Mississippi to a lawyer in Savannah, Georgia. And no one had listened to those tapes until I went and listened to them. And it was amazing because he didn't mention his wife by name in these 28 cassette tapes. He barely mentioned my dad. And from that, through my father, there's a portrait of him, of course, in this book, as you know. And he's a much more verbal person, but still, he's got a lot of short kind of dadisms, as we call them. He makes Twitter seem expansive because they're so short.
He's a man, by the way, who is happy to live his life between the commas. The commas being anything that acknowledges that he's the parent of you or your brother, Bruce Feiler, son of Edwin Feiler, wasn't it?
Edwin Feiler, yes. Yeah, did something today, was on Here and Now today.
Right.
But still, he also didn't talk about his feelings a lot, didn't have close friendships. To then me, with these friends, spending an entire year writing a book of wisdom for my daughters, there is a kind of story there of the evolution of being male in America that turns out to be one of the themes that emerges from the Council of Dads.
Bruce Feiler, his book is The Council of Dads, My Daughters, My Illness, and the Men Who Could Be Me. Some of the other things these male friends told him, they'd tell his daughters. Live the questions. When you have one, go find the answer. Tend the tadpoles. That's a childhood friend. He and his friend used to go and hunt tadpoles. When we come back, how Bruce's deep study of the Bible influenced what he calls his lost year, that year of being treated for and recovering, thankfully, from cancer. We'll be back with more from Bruce later in the program, the latest from the French Open with Bud Collins. Back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Bruce Feiler. His new book is The Council of Dads, My Daughters, My Illness, and the Men Who Could Be Me. It's the story of the group of men he called on to take his place, if need be, after he found out he had a vicious cancer in his leg 2 years ago. And Bruce, before the break, you were talking about a genesis from your grandfather's stoic reticence to, you know, you, the talker with your male friends. And you make a lot of biblical references in the book, as someone who's written about the Bible, including in the book of Genesis. You write, before there is order, there's chaos. Before there is light, there is darkness. And what is the only force strong enough to overcome that disorder? What does God use to create the world? Words. And that's what you told your girls.
Use your words. Use your words. That became a kind of motto. I mean, one of the things that we struggled with was how much to tell our children. And it was actually me who insisted that we be honest, but not too honest. And a couple times I was in the hospital and didn't share with them where I was. And then one night I used to play this game with my girls where I would say, give me some characters and I'll make up a story. And they said they wanted two characters who didn't have families. And I was like, uh-oh. Were you scared when Daddy was in the hospital? and Eden, one of my daughters, said, I was very, 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 very scared. And so I said, okay, we're going to have a new game called Would You Like to Ask Daddy a Question? I brought them into my office one at a time, and I explained to them I was in the hospital, and I said, do you have any questions? And Eden said, well, where did you sleep when you were at the hospital? And I said, oh, well, they have beds. And that was quite revealing to her because her doctors didn't have beds. Then Tybee came in, and she said, where did you eat when you were in the hospital? And I said, well, they have a restaurant. And she's like, Daddy, this conversation has gone on long enough. And then she went running, Eden, guess what? They have a restaurant in the hospital. And to me, it was such a lesson. It's like here we had said to them, use your words, and now we had to take our own advice.
Right. How else did your deep study of the Bible and the figures in the Bible help you get through this? I'm thinking, first of all, it may have been where, you know, even the council of dads having this almost board, you know, advise you. I'm picturing the Last Supper.
I would say that the idea that resonated most from the Bible to me actually does come from Moses. You mentioned earlier that I had written this book, America's Prophet, about the influence of Moses in America. And there's a quote from Moses on the side of the Liberty Bell, proclaim liberty through all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. And that comes from a passage in the book of Leviticus, which it says that the Israelites are supposed to let their land lay fallow every 7 years. And every seven sets of 7 years, every 49 years, there's supposed to be an additional year of rest, during which time all families are to be reunited and all people joined with the people that they love. That 50th year is called the Jubilee year. It's actually the origin of the word Jubilee. And though I'm a little shy of 50 yet, that perfectly captures my experience, that my lost year became my Jubilee year. And in lying fallow, I would say I became more fertile. And in taking pause, I really set myself up for a more active future. And in forming this Council of Dads, I really was reunited with the people I love and was surrounded by this new community with my girls at its heart. And that's really became the sort of the core lesson that I took from my experience, which is if you're moving too fast yourself, if you've ever felt pain or alone or a loss, if you've ever been uplifted by the people around you, I think if you come on this journey with me, I think you'll be moved by the wisdom that you hear from these men. I think you'll be inspired to reach out to your own friends and form a new community. And ultimately, I think you will just feel at peace with this feeling of security and of love and of hope.
Well, in fact, the very last page of the book, you tell readers for tips on creating your own council of dads or council of moms. Or if they want to find out about sarcomas and other rare cancers like the one you had, you ask them to go to your website or another website, Council of Dads. We'll have them both at ours, hereandnow.org, so people can just be linked. But what are people telling you?
A single mom I know recently who's estranged from the father of her son has created a Council of Dads so that her son can have male figures. I'm doing a program with the U.S. military for military dads to create councils of dads because they spend time away from their kids and also think about mortality. Parents of teenagers are telling me that they need councils because their kids need separation from them. So it's just interesting that everybody hears the idea, but they do something different. And recently, we had the Council of Dads together for the first time. They convened for the first time when our girls turned 5 not long ago. And everybody went around and talked about how the experience had changed them. And you mentioned earlier my contrarian friend, Ben, and he said, you know, when I first heard this idea, I rejected it. You were going to survive. We didn't need this council, and it was a bad idea. And he said, I have to say, today I realized that I was wrong. He said, I realized that whether we're healthy or sick or male or female, that we all do need to be surrounded by the ones we love. And in particular, when I saw the looks on your girls' faces today and how they each have a relationship with each of us, he said, that's when I realized that we all need our own counsel.
Yeah. Well, Bruce Feiler, in the many letters, beautiful letters that you continually wrote to friends and family and the Council of Dads, you always closed by saying, take a walk for me or walk for me. Are you going back on your walks?
Not long ago, I stepped out of my house and went down the stairs and took a few steps on the street, and then I stopped, and I realized for the first time in 15 months, I was walking without any aid, without crutches. And walking was the first thing that I lost, and as a result, I spent a lot of time thinking about it. You hurry, you get to your destination, but you get there alone. You go slow, you get to your destination, but you get there with this community that you've developed along the way. And I just came to appreciate the value of moving slowly. And one of the things that I found in the course of thinking about walking is that in the 1840s, a new kind of pedestrian appeared in Paris. He was called a flaneur, and he was a man of leisure who ambled the arcades. And it was a custom among these flaneurs to take a turtle for a walk and let the reptile set the pace. And I came to love this ode to slow moving, and it really became a motto for my daughters. Take a walk with the turtle. Behold the world in pause. And every now and then, stop entirely.
That's Bruce Feiler. His new book is The Council of Dads, My Daughters, My Illness, and The Men Who Could Be Me. He's also, of course, the author of Walking the Bible and many other books. And so, Bruce, we're thrilled to hear that you will be walking slowly through fascinating parts of the world and reporting back to us about them. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for your support over many years.
Okay. Monday on Here and Now, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan's going to join us. Is he trying to get rid of teacher tenure? That's Monday. But still ahead today, it's the family farm versus Homeland Security in a dispute over 5 acres in Vermont. That's after the latest news, Here and Now. Thailand's prime minister says order has been restored in Bangkok, but so far there's been no word of new elections, one of the key demands of the anti-government red shirt protesters who paralyzed the capital for weeks until the military overran their encampment on Wednesday, killing more than 50 people. The BBC's Lucy Williamson reports on the aftermath of the protests.
Jump on a motorbike at the old protest site and drive south, and in about 5 or 10 minutes, you'll end up here in Bong Khai. You'll know you're here when you see the big burnt-out building on the main road and the scorch marks left by the barricades and the army lines. People here have had a pretty rough time over the last few weeks, and so we've come to talk to them about how they feel now the operation's over. Hello.
Hello.
Lucy from BBC.
Oh, BBC.
We've bumped into Sombat, who sells motorbikes here in the community. He's sitting in the back of his pickup truck on this warm afternoon, and he says he just came back today. He left his home here because he said it was just too dangerous.
I just come back today.
Why did you leave?
They're fighting like that, shooting both sides.
Shooting on both sides.
From there is soldier, and from here is the red church. Army and people are
military, and this side is a leisure protester.
Right, so I should explain to our listeners, we're just standing looking out onto a main road here, and people here are telling me that on the right-hand side there was the army, on the left-hand side there were the protesters, and
yes,
they were shooting at each other.
Yes.
The situation like this is very difficult for the people, not peace, everybody fear.
No peace, everyone's scared.
Yeah.
You think the problem hasn't gone away?
Because now some people are dead, this is the big problem later.
Walking on a bit further, we come to the house of Pisit Charonphron, one of the community leaders. He takes us on a little walk around the area, past the bird shop and the fresh pile of red canisters at the side of the road. What's this? It's a pile of fire extinguishers. Used ones. Who used these? The fire brigade or the local people?
The residents in this community.
Was the fire brigade not here?
Fire brigade couldn't come into this area because they've been fired by someone.
The fire brigade was being shot at. What do you think about the state of Thailand at the moment? In my opinion, he says, the government was too slow to act. It shouldn't have let this rally escalate until it couldn't control it. It's bad for the country, bad for investment, bad for tourists, and it looks bad for the future. We don't know what's going to happen, what will be the solution. Right. So we're just coming now to interview one of the oldest residents of Bong Khai, and here we are. Hello, what's your name? How long have you lived here?
She lived here since she was born, and she is 82 years now.
What did you see yesterday?
I saw them put fire to many places. I'm really afraid.
What did you think about the government's decision to use the army to end the protest?
It's good to bring things to the end.
Do you think it's really ended?
ถ้าเป็นอย่างนี้ไปนะ
This end is not like a real end
เอามาเล็กๆน้อยๆเขาบอกข้างเตยยังมีอยู
่ This crisis has made it clear how deep the divisions are in Thailand on some really big issues about democracy and how government should work. The crisis here might be over, the burning might largely have stopped for now, but people here are quite clear about one thing. They don't really believe it's over.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson in Bangkok. Let's take a quick second to say we always love to hear from you. You can go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or just scroll down and leave a comment right there, hereandnow.org. You can also follow us at Twitter at hereandnow and on XM Sirius Radio all over the place. Just ahead, Homeland Security is eyeing farmland along the Vermont-Canada border for additional security, but the family that runs the farm says they need it to make hay. Back in a bit with that, Here and Now. The U.S. government says that the Morse's Line crossing station on the border between Canada and Franklin, Vermont, way up there in the Northeast Kingdom, is a weak link in its chain securing the country's borders. And to make improvements to the 76-year-old facility, it needs to acquire 5 acres of farmland belonging to the Rainville family. If the Rainvilles don't take the government's offer of a little over $39,000, the government will take the land by eminent domain. Brian Rainville joins us. He's a school teacher. His father and two brothers farm the land. And Brian, your family's response to Washington's offer.
My family's response is, why are they asking us to buy land when their own report shows that exactly this type of facility should be closed?
Well, it is a smaller facility, about, what, 14,000, maybe 15,000 cars cross annually. It's not a big facility.
Correct. There's no commercial traffic permitted. It's closed from midnight to 8 a.m., during which the border is secured with a gate and electronic monitoring and the Border Patrol. And we're at a loss to understand why an agency that's done such a fine job securing the border that way needs to go and create a new port for traffic that doesn't even exist.
And the government is saying that because it's so run down, there's no place to inspect vehicles, the detention center is just a set of handcuffs attached to a wooden bench. They need to improve it. But you also are a little insulted by the offer of, what, $39,500. What do you use those 5 acres for? What are they worth to you?
Those 5 acres produce 1,000 bales of hay a year. The soil tests that the agency did down there show it's some of the finest farmland in the state of Vermont. And I have a real problem with somebody from Washington who has no proven need for a new facility walking in and calling some of the best farmland in this state a vacant lot.
What do you think it's worth?
To us, it's priceless. We have never sold a lot since 1946. We have never converted agricultural land to another use, and we have no intention of doing so. This isn't about my family wanting more money. This is about an agency taking an allocation that Congress gave them for critical port facilities and deciding to dump it into a place that gets 2.5 cars an hour.
Well, but it is a little bit about the money, only in that those acres are critical to the farm. And, you know, that hay feeds the cattle. Without the hay to feed the cattle, you don't have the farm.
And thank you, because you understand that. I've had to explain it to our friends from Washington over and over again. They argue that we sell hay, and I keep having to tell them, we don't sell hay, we grow hay to feed the cows that produce milk.
Well, Brian Rainville, what would your family like to see done?
I want them to follow their own recommendations and close Morse's Line and take this money 10 miles west of us to Highgate, Vermont, one of the largest, busiest ports in the state of Vermont, add additional truck lanes. There's only one. Commercial traffic backs up there for hours. And take the staff that's sitting at Morse's Line waiting for traffic, put them over in Highgate where they only staff 2 of their 5 vehicle lanes.
And we should just say, I'm sure there are a couple of your neighbors that are going back and forth to see relatives, and we understand there's an occasional hockey game, but you're saying they could go 10 miles down to the other facility.
People are telling us very clearly, we don't want to lose your farm for the sake of a couple of miles of traffic.
Brian,
we'll make the effort. We appreciate what you do.
By the way, you are a civics teacher. Is this a topic in the class?
It is a topic in the class. I tried to keep a wall of separation, but my students were intensely interested, and I had a young lady who looked up this morning and said, I now understand why you teach history. We need the Constitution to protect ourselves.
And by the way, what do you tell them is the Constitution says about this?
Well, the Constitution says you can take private property, but you have to show a public good.
Brian Rainville, he and his family trying to stop the government from seizing 5 acres of their farmland in Vermont to upgrade a small crossing station at the Canadian border. Brian, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
The French Open begins Sunday, and Spaniard Rafael Nadal, always a favorite on the clay courts at Roland Garros, but recovering from knee injuries, says, "I've got my best tennis back." Well, look out, Roger Federer. Ah, it must be spring. Three-time champion Nadal's rank is back up to number 2. Defending champion Federer is number 1, and Bud Collins is in Paris. Bud, what's the early word on Nadal?
Well, Nadal, I really worried about him. Last year he played terribly at the U.S. Open, trying to rehabilitate his knees, but they've come through okay. No more squeeze by the knees. And he looks very good. You know, he beat Roger Federer. He's 14-7 against Federer. He beat him to win Madrid 2 weeks ago. And a lot of people say, why don't they just put these two guys out there and let them play 7 rounds against each other? Because who else do you see winning this tournament? But Federer has not been all that sensational. He's lost 5 matches. That amounts to a drought for him at this stage of the year, and he lost to people you've never heard of.
But do you think there's any other dark horses, anyone we should keep an eye on?
Well, it was Robin Soderling who beat Nadal last year in the 4th round, but he showed very little since then. There are so many people out with injuries. You've got Juan Martin Del Potro, who beat Federer in the U.S. Open final last year, but now he's out with wrist problems. Andy Roddick is out with a variety of injuries. James Blake won't be here. It doesn't look like there's anybody else.
The other people, of course, that we're watching are the women. We're used to seeing the Williams sisters in major tennis finals, but this hasn't really been their tournament?
No, it hasn't. They did play against one another 8 years ago, and Serena won that one. And that's the only time Serena has won the French Open. The defending champion is Svetlana Kuznetsova, and she hasn't been doing much. Dinara Safina came in here as number 1 last year, lost in the final, and has barely won a match since. And I thought Kim Clijsters would have a good chance, but she's out with a foot injury. So the women, almost anybody can win. I was fascinated a couple of weeks ago in Rome at the final of the Italian Open when a woman with a freight train-like name, Maria Jose Martinez Sanchez, won the title. She's 27. She was using drop shots, and she was volleying, coming to the net. You don't see that in women's tennis. So I'd like to see her do something.
Well, finally, Bud Collins, your tailor, Charlie Davidson, recently gave me a rare visit to the inner sanctum of the Andover shop here in Cambridge, where your pants are made.
That's like Fort Knox.
I understand. What will you be wearing?
It depends. If Nadal is in the final, probably I ought to wear my Italian pantaloni fascisti, they're called, which were the colors of the old fascist party. Not very nice today, but a friend of mine, an Italian journalist, Johnny Clerici, and I, in a moment of rash judgment, tore that banner down because he didn't like the Italian party that it represented.
Wait a minute. You have pants made out of the flag that you tore down?
It's not a flag. It's an election banner of the party, is the Movimento Sociale. And Clerici so disliked them that he insisted we tear down their banner. And then he said, gee, what are we going to do with it? I said, we're going to have trousers made out of it.
Bud Collins, Mr. Tennis with the Boston Globe in Paris ahead of Sunday's French Open. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay, before we go today, the latest trends in culinary cuisine, recipes out, 20-something chefs in. You're listening to Here and Now. Every year, the International Association of Culinary Professionals holds an annual meeting. Close to 1,000 food writers, food editors, cookbook authors from more than 20 countries, and Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, gather to talk about the state of the food world. And Kathy joins us to talk about what she learned at this year's gathering in the totally hip, young, pierced, and food-obsessed city of Portland, Oregon. Kathy, welcome.
Hi, Robin. It's all true. Everyone was tattooed. It's just this great-looking demographic.
Well, and they're very into food. And joining them, 1,000 food professionals from all over the world. So Give us some of the buzz from the conference.
There was a lot of talk about local foods, of course, which we've all heard a lot about, but we still need to get closer to this. There was talks about the death of recipes. Do we need recipes?
Do we need recipes? Cookbook writers would go out of business.
Well, it would be a whole different approach of talking about how you cook food without actually following a scientific measurement. It's a few steps above, but I would say the prevailing talk was about the economy and the recession and how it's affected food in this country and how food writers have had to change their take on it. So one of the people I talked to, the keynote speaker, very famous, Ruth Reichel, mm-hmm. author, ex-editor of Gourmet magazine, she had some interesting thoughts.
I think people had to learn to cook less expensive food, stop using so much processed food and cook things from scratch just because they were forced to because of the economy. And part of me wishes that the recession would stay around a little bit for people to learn to cook again.
You know, I understand where she's coming from, but I'm sure a lot of people are going to take exception with that sentiment. Those that have been out of work for a while are not too thrilled about this recession.
I guess this is true. I know of people who are making a lot more casseroles and just throwing whatever is left over into the pot, but she really believes that people are cooking more because of the recession.
A lot of people believe this, and a lot of people have seen it. There is a return to the kitchen table as opposed to the restaurant table. I also spoke with Kim Severson, who's a food writer for the New York Times. She's author of a new book called Spoon Fed, and she talked about how the budget and the recession has affected her writing.
We've certainly done our share of how to do a budget dinner for $50. I don't think that, you know, you want to give your dining readers a steady diet of hamburger and cheap cuts, you know, so we found some sort of clever ways to write about food. But, you know, it's that high-end luxury that's gone now. So the $5,000 bottle of wine, the very gilded restaurant dining experience is certainly not in fashion in New York these days, and our coverage reflects that change, I think.
So, Kathy Gunst, are you saying that the headline from the conference is that home cooking and cutting some corners is a trend?
I would say that, and it's interesting because in past conferences, that word trend is right at the tip of everyone's, what's hot? What can I tell my readers? What can I go back with? It was sort of an anti-trend year. Nobody wanted to say, oh, it's Korean, it's Thai, it's Indonesian. If there was a trend other than talking about getting back home, it was about children and about youth. There were a lot of workshops about teaching young children to go to farmers markets and taste raw produce and fruit.
Well, and not just that, the idea of this new wave of young celebrity chefs. I mean, the Food Network is starting a whole younger, hipper channel for these younger, hipper chefs.
That's exactly right. I would say every restaurant I went to in Portland, Oregon, the chef was in their 20s.
Wow.
Tattooed, pierced, adorable, and obsessed, all capitals, with finding local food, with fresh foods, with seasonal foods, all those buzzwords. And I will also say that I did not eat a single bad meal in that city. Ruth Reichel, again, talks to this topic. She tells a story about going across the country to promote the Gourmet Cookbook, all that's left of Gourmet at this point, and talks about youth.
When parents were buying the book, and they'd say, you know, I'm buying this for my child, and more often than not, it was for a guy. And I think that that's a change that's going to have a really, I think it's going to have a lasting impact on how America eats.
Talk more about this, youth and food.
A lot of people believe that kids are going to do for food what kids did for cigarettes. In other words, a lot of young children were educated about how bad tobacco was for them. They came home, they saw their parents slouched in their chairs smoking cigarettes, and they're like, Mom, Dad, you're going to die. You've got to quit. And if kids get educated at a young age and they come home and they see their parents serving processed food after they've taken a field trip and eaten rhubarb for the first time or take a bite into a freshly harvested tomato and had juices dripped down them and understood how delicious it was, there's some belief that kids will then change what parents cook and serve them. Again, Kim Severson from the New York Times. I asked her about this food trends of the youth and how young 20-somethings are sort of embracing food like it's never happened before.
The whole gastro-hipster thing is a little maddening, like if it's cool and it's old-fashioned and, you know, there's a bunch of guys in Williamsburg making pickles and it's like the coolest thing ever. That's a little annoying. God bless them. But at the flip side of that is that you have young people who are cooking like never before. You know, so the fact of the matter is most of these people are in their 20s, maybe their early 30s, and they really are interested in where their food came from, and they know how to cook. And, you know, kids are going out at Friend College and having, you know, pig roast in empty fields. They used to go out and have keggers in empty fields, and kids are going out to have pig roast. So I think that is just monumental. It's a huge change.
Kathy, I get what Kim is saying, because I can hear my cousin in Vermont who cans her own tomatoes and grows her own food and does her own maple syrup saying, what's hip about this? I've been doing this for decades. And, you know, some kid in Brooklyn does it and charges $20 for a bottle of pickles.
Well, that's exactly her point. It's gotten so precious that it's a little bit overboard. But if you can bring a new generation into eating well and understanding the importance of nutrition and healthy foods as opposed to, you know, bologna and potato chips, this is a positive thing for sure.
It's a good thing, as someone else would say. Well, just briefly, Kathy, before you go, tell us a little more about Portland, Oregon, as a food city.
Well, it's fascinating because it's not just the restaurants and these hipsters. A lot of people have compared the city now to the independent or the indie film world. In other words, you don't need $1 million and 10 backers and a famous name to start a restaurant. What Portland, Oregon has introduced are food carts. The city's designated parking lots to these carts. There's over 400 of them. You can eat Korean, Vietnamese, Mexican, Lebanese food. You get a license for about $300, and it's amazing food. Meredith Deeds, a food writer and a board member of IACP, who spent a lot of time in downtown Portland, talks about it.
As you walk along the streets of Portland, you may pass, right in our downtown area here, a parking lot that might be filled with 40 food carts, and each of these carts selling extraordinary food for low prices. You're having gourmet, essentially, food for an extraordinary deal, and they're all lined up right next to each other. So it's this extravagant array of choices.
I think this food cart trend is sort of emblematic of a lot of what's happening in food these days. It's less high-end restaurants, more authentic, and in some cases, immigrant food, you know, really authentic, the real thing. Seasonal, local are still huge words in the food world. But I think people are looking for purer tastes at lower costs. And whether it happens at home or in a food cart or walking along the street and having a picnic in the summertime, the idea of just getting back to simple, fresh eating.
Again, I can hear a lot of listeners saying, for them, it never went away.
I'm sure a lot of people feel that way, but there are many, many people who have not been eating well, and our obesity rates and a look in the grocery store will confirm that.
Kathy Gunst, Here and Now resident chef and author of two new books, Stonewall Kitchen Grilling and Stonewall Kitchen Appetizers. Check those out. Kathy, welcome back from Portland, and thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be here.